Daniel, if an asteroid then was coming our way beyond a test, I mean, what do you think we can do? I mean, would you advocate blowing it up with a nuclear bomb?
Well, actually, I think we can do better than that. The problem with doing something like, you know, that's sort of an impulsive deflection scenario. You either blow it to smithereens, which
you might create more little asteroids.
You still got all this material coming at you.
Yeah,
right? Now you
exactly.
Have a shotgun rather than one bullet. It's a very uncontrolled way. Remember this very issue that we were just talking about, this keyhole issue. It doesn't do you very good to move an object that might be coming at you this year and move it in an uncontrolled fashion that lets it slip into one of these keyholes only to come back and get you again later on. We prefer, B612 Foundation prefers, methods that allow you to control the deflection. To do a slow, gentle, there are reasons for doing it slow and gentle, but the slow and gentle for one reason allows you to keep control over the object, to make sure you know where it's going during the deflection so that it won't cause your grandchildren a problem. Slow is also another good reason because many of these objects are fragile enough. We've seen evidence for this in the way objects have been ripped apart in the past. We haven't seen that ourselves in history, but we see the evidence of ripped apart asteroids in the fact that 1 in 5 near-Earth asteroids is actually a binary. They have moons. And the process that leads to that is having a weak asteroid torn asunder by the gravity of the Earth as it passes by during a very close pass. That tells us that at least some of them are relatively weak. If you try to go out and push aggressively or do something aggressive, if you will, to one of these weak objects,
it might make it worse.
It might make things worse. So you want to go out there and gently push.
This deep impact project where we're landing on a comet and we're going to blow part of it up in July, is that really a test to see what's this comet's makeup, or are we testing our ability to land again? I know it's been done, but to land again on an object and see what we can do with it?
Well, a little bit of both. The primary purpose of deep impact is to impact the comet. And it we're not going to land on it. The spacecraft actually consists of two different parts, if you will. One being a large of order 800-pound copper projectile, which will basically separate from the main spacecraft and then just fly into the oncoming path of this comet. So we're letting the orbital speed of the comet around the sun do most of the work for us. We just fly and maneuver the copper projectile into its path. It's going to strike the comet at about a little over 10 kilometers per second. That's very fast. And we're expecting this thing to make a crater on the asteroid of order the size of a football stadium. And that's the primary purpose, is to expose in that cratering process some of the materials on the interior of this comet and help us better understand the surface and internal structure of the composition and structure of this object. That secondarily actually serves the purpose of your second half of the question, which is teaching us a little bit more about this process of how one might go about moving or deflecting a threatening object. It's not its main purpose, but it's going to be a natural byproduct of that process. We're going to learn more about what these objects are made out of and how one might go about pushing them in the future.
To the phones we go, Wildcard Line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with Dan Durda. Hi there.
Hi there. I'm John in Jackson, Tennessee. I'd like to ask John if what would the Earth be like if we were 50,000 or 100,000 miles further or nearer to the sun?
Interesting.
Hey John, very good question. That gets into this question of what is the sun's habitable zone? How close or how far can you be to have actually life? We used to think that the sun's habitable zone was relatively narrow, so that a small change. So if you live on Venus, for instance, it's too hot. Mars is too cold. Earth is right in the middle. A relatively small change that you're talking about of order of, 50 or 100,000 kilometers, that's already within the size scale of the orbital variations that the Earth naturally goes through over time due to the tugs and pulls of the other planets. Those variations do cause climatic variations. They're partially responsible for the cycle of ice ages, glaciations that we go through. we're living in an ice age right now, right? We're just between glaciations.
I think we are, too.
Well, I mean, ice ages last millions of years. The individual glaciations within those ice ages last of order 100,000 years. Right now, we're just between glaciations. The cycles, the timings of those advances and retreats are driven partially by these orbital variations that are on the scale of what John just pointed out.
Do you think? Do you actually believe that we are going to get hit within the next 20 years? I know you don't have any data that would back that up, but isn't it just a matter of time, Dan?
Oh, it is just a matter of time, and it's just a matter of the size of the impact. Are we going to be hit by something in 20 years? Absolutely. But is it going to be big enough to have any consequence? And likely not. But, I mean, we're, as I said, every month we're hit by objects the size of probably the room that you're sitting in, and those cause relatively, it'll cause something the equivalent of a decent sonic boom in the atmosphere that will rattle and possibly even break a window or two. In 20 years, will we be hit by something as, big enough to be a significant local or regional damage? The odds are not. I mean, things like, for instance, what I would consider a significant impact for me personally would be something of order like the Tunguska event, which,
mm-hmm.
Was 1,000 times more powerful than the bomb that wiped out Hiroshima. That occurred in 1908 over Siberia, flattened 1,600 square kilometers of forest. Those types of impacts happen on the Earth on timescales of millennia. So in the next 20 years only, it's not likely. The odds are, 20 out of 2,000, right?
Could be. West of the Rockies, your turn. You're on. Hi.
Hi. I have two brief questions, and
sure.
I'll hang up and listen to your response. Hey, how many years do you think we are away from mounting a camera or telescope of some sort on a comet? That'd be one nice ride.
Mm-hmm.
And the second question is, with the Vatican, I understand, just recently purchased this observatory, and the United States just recently launching this missile at this comet. I had this dream not too long ago about the Earth going through the tail of a wounded comet, and we just got pelted with great hail and ice stones that were in the tail of this thing.
Oh, very interesting stuff.
Yeah, let's check that one
those
first.
Are great questions. How many years till we have a telescope, an actual extraterrestrial telescope, if you will, not just necessarily floating in space like Hubble, but mounted on another object? In fact, we already had one in 1972. The very first telescope on the moon was an ultraviolet telescope placed there during the Apollo 16 mission. It actually photographed the Earth in the ultraviolet wave band because there's no atmosphere on the moon to filter out or block the ultraviolet light. So we use that opportunity to photograph the Earth from afar and look at the aurora and the outer atmosphere of the Earth in the ultraviolet. I have no doubt that as we continue to move back to the moon and beyond, that we're going to have other telescopes there. I think that'll be a natural byproduct of the new initiative to return us to the moon. I suspect a decent professional grade telescope on the moon probably in, of order 30 years or so, I would guess. I'm sure it'll be one of the very first things that we do as we expand science on the moon when we go back there. In terms of passing through the tail of a comet, boy, that was a big concern back in 1910. There were all kinds of crazy notions going on because astronomers had just recently, just before the 1910 apparition of Halley's Comet, astronomers had discovered the cyanogen gas in the tail of a comet. You detect these spectroscopically by looking at the wavelengths of sunlight absorbed by the gas in the tail of the comet, or in some cases even emitted as the molecules fluoresce by the light from the sun. And astronomers had detected this, and people were going nuts because we knew that we were going to pass very close, if not through, the tail of Halley's Comet in 1910, and people were concerned we'd be poisoned. Didn't seem to be comforted by the fact that the tail was so incredibly diffuse. But debris in the tails of comets, though, we do know that comets are the sources of meteor showers. They leave a trail of debris as the ices evaporate off the comet nucleus as they pass near the sun. some of the rocky bits and dusty bits of debris are released in that same process, and it leaves a trail of debris behind the comet. If the Earth passes through that trail of debris, we see it raining through our atmosphere as meteors. But more importantly, and more directly to your question, it can have some significant consequences for us, because if we were ever in modern times now to really pass directly through, close to the coma of a comet, and these things happen, and we had Comet Hale-Bopp and Comet Yakutake in the last decade come relatively near us, close enough, and we could actually pass through that tail of debris, not necessarily damaging to us here on the Earth, we're protected by our atmosphere, but boy, you know, our communication satellites, our GPS satellites are out there naked in space, and we could lose a significant fraction of our very important satellite constellations by passing very near or through the inner parts of the coma or inner tail of a comet. That would be bad. That'd be very bad.
Do you
devastating economically.
If an asteroid plunges into the oceans, a mile wide, what kind of tsunami would that create?
Oh goodness, you answered the question by specifying the size for me. A mile wide, that's a significant impact that would probably cause a tsunami more devastating than what we just saw in Southeast Asia. We've talked about this for a number of years in the asteroid impact community, but I don't think people ever completely grasped the idea of what a tsunami can do. I think, unfortunately, nature has now demonstrated for us in a very graphic and vivid way and made it very much more tied to our experience what the devastation can be from one of these types of impacts.
Would it be instant, too? The minute it hits, how long would it take to hit coastal lines, let's say?
Well, these tsunamis can travel very fast. You've got maybe hours of warning time at best, if you're lucky, to maybe start to evacuate. I think if something that size were going to hit, we'd know it enough ahead of time to know where, and one could then be prepared to evacuate coastlines along the way. There's a trick, though, to asteroid impact tsunamis. The tsunami that caused the Southeast Asia tsunami was caused by tectonic activity, an earthquake. The wavelength of water waves that are generated during an earthquake are different. They're longer than the wavelengths made by the impact of an asteroid in the ocean. It's essentially a splash. It's like throwing a big cobble into a pond.
And it depends on the angle, too, right?
Partially the angle, although the cavity of water that expands doesn't know about the angle very much until it gets to be a very, very glancing blow. So it's more the fact that it's a concussive surface cavity carved out of the surface of the water, which then immediately collapses, fills back in, and then overshoots and drives these much higher frequency waves than are caused by earthquakes. The effect of that, though, is that impact tsunamis tend to break offshore much more easily than an earthquake tsunami does. And so that's the complicating bit here. It looks as though perhaps impact tsunamis are not as big a threat as we once thought, but if the impactor gets big enough, they can be.
Absolutely. Let's go east of the Rockies. You're on. Hi there.
Yeah, Scott from Ohio.
Hi, Scott.
Yeah, good show, Jordan. Dan, I got a question. We'll go back to intelligence on the different planets.
Sure.
If there's anything else out there, start off with. I'll just go ahead and give this to you, and then I'll get off the Big Bang Theory. Possibly the planet maybe that was inhabited prior to us being sucked into the sun and exploding, causing the Big Bang Theory, and forcing us to go ahead and hop from planet to planet. You take, for example, the structures that are only seen from space or in the sky as possibly landing points or whatever, the pyramids and Stonehenge, some of the things that we can't really explain, were they kind of used for us to come from one planet to another? There's just so many different theories that we've heard or talked about. But that's basically my theory of the Big Bang Theory, how the the planets get sucked into the sun, and we've just basically hopped from planet to planet. I mean, Mars, they say, has water underneath there, frozen everything. What was Venus like, you know, millions of years ago?
I've always had, Dan, and thanks for your call, Scott. I've always had a theory that it wasn't a little tiny pin dot that exploded and created the universe. It was a massive size object that exploded and created what's in the universe.
Yeah, the Big Bang is so hard for us to wrap our brain around because it's so outside of our normal, you know, everyday experience, the size scales, the time scales involved, just the basic concepts. It's we tend to think of our world naturally as we do because we move around it in a very three-dimensional form, and so we tend to think of things happening in the context of, you know, there's a room full of space within which things happen, and it's tempting to think of the Big Bang, which we have evidence for from, you know, the expansion of space around us, galaxies all moving around away from each other, and the actual radio noise, the radio glow left over from the actual event itself, which we can detect. It's tempting to think of the Big Bang as somehow being an explosive something expanding into space, you know, around it. But the Big Bang was the actual origin of space itself, and it's a little confusing, a little tempting to think of it in more conventional terms that obscure the real notion there. It's if you think of the conventional sort of analogs are to think of our you know, we live in a three-dimensional universe which is curved and warped into a fourth, you know, a fourth dimension. And is evolving in that way. We can think of it though by collapsing the analogy down to a two-dimensional universe, expanding into a third dimension by thinking of the surface of a balloon that's expanding. The surface of that balloon, that two-dimensional surface of that balloon, you can think of as space and the universe, and it's expanding into a third dimension. And that, if you imagine running that expanding balloon back in time and letting the air out of it and collapsing down, you eventually hit a point where that two-dimensional surface of that little universe just disappears altogether down to this little thing. Well, imagine all of three-dimensional space running backwards and collapsing down into nothingness. That's the sort of event we're thinking of there, so it's pretty tricky to wrap our brains around.
Oh, my, what a very fast show this has been, but we've still got a half hour to go with the rest of your phone calls and our guest Daniel Derda right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie.